Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Oliver Rosales on the show. Dr. Rosales is a professor of history and former faculty coordinator of the Social Justice Institute at Bakersfield College, and most recently the author of Civil Rights in Bakersfield, Segregation and Multiracial Activism in the Central Valley. We cover a lot in this podcast, including the history of Bakersfield, the history of segregation, the centrality of farm labor activism, and expanding the tent to include more histories within those broader stories, and much more. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Oliver Rosales. Dr. Rosales, what do those who live outside of Bakersfield perceive accurately and inaccurately about the city?
I think there's a lot of truth and humor into how Bakersfield has been portrayed in popular culture and media, and then obviously a lot of misunderstandings. I certainly think that the low educational attainment rates of the population have been a source of humor, from Johnny Carson to other late night talk show hosts, especially folks in Los Angeles who probably view Bakersfield as being a backwater. Again, the data certainly supports that in terms of outcomes with education and literacy. I also think that a lot of folks who commute from Northern to Southern California don't come off the 99, or they don't come off Interstate 5. And unless they have a reason to visit Bakersfield, they kind of don't know that it's a fairly large city, that it has a lot of culture, a lot of history. And part of that is, I think, a problem with the academics and research, right? There's not a lot of research on the Central Valley. It's limited compared to something like Southern California studies. So I hope that's changing. And there's a difference even within the Valley. The Valley is very big. The Southern San Joaquin Valley, I think, is dominated by public knowledge of the farmworker movement and perhaps the Bakersfield Sound. But there's a whole other urban history of race relations, and as I get into my book, A History of Civil Rights, that hasn't been accounted for. And I think coming up as a young person, wanting to see myself reflected in the curriculum, I was bent on trying to write that history. So again, I think there's a lot of truth to the kind of stereotypes that are given toward a place like Bakersfield, but then there's also tremendous levels of ignorance from the outside world who don't spend time in the Valley and recognize it for its kind of unique political, you know, and social cultural history.
I'm familiar with the kind of effects that big city liberals' critique of Bakersfield elicits within the conservative wing of Bakersfield. It's like a badge of honor or like a bona fides for conservatism if the big city or these big progressive metropolises around the coasts in California, if they don't like you, that means you're doing something right. But I'm curious, like, what the effect of that has on the more progressive elements in Bakersfield, because I'm sure that it can feel a little bit like you're being overlooked in some capacity as you're like working hard on the quote front lines in a city where maybe you're a minority in terms of the kind of distribution of political worldviews that exist there. So how does it affect progressive elements in Bakersfield?
That's such an interesting question. I think on the one hand, progressive organizations, social justice groups who have been on the ground organizing and doing social justice work, political mobilization, say for the past 20 years, in some ways have been doing it in a kind of vacuum where they're disconnected from the past or their more recent immigrants to the city. I'm 44 years old. My history has been in and out of the city for the past 20 years, especially with graduate school and such. And the population of the city grew very rapidly after 2000, with new immigration coming in, the development of West Bakersfield, and just new immigrants, many coming from, I think, across the country, but especially Southern California because of property values. And a lot of those folks who have come in that I've seen, even among organizations, they don't know the history of the city. So some of the organizing work that they're doing is disconnected from the antecedents, both oppositionary forces, but also, I think, on the social justice side. At the same time, because of the legacy of the United Farm Workers, the organizing tradition, I think, in Bakersfield, Greater Bakersfield, Delano, has been a kind of beacon of hope for I think so many on the left, the progressive left, the American Union movement. And I think progressive organizations kind of tap into that and recognize that, rightfully so, to galvanize their populations and their communities that they're trying to organize to challenge, among other things, what I call legacies of racial segregation, but also other forms of inequalities or poor health outcomes, et cetera. Again, I applaud a lot of the progressive organizations on the ground doing work today and hope that my book, again, I say it somewhere in there, gives them a genealogy, right, to their rights organizing and know that they're drawing upon a really rich legacy of challenging the status quo and the powers that be in the valley.
This next question, I think we could probably spend a lot of time on it, but I want you to briefly capture how does Bakersfield tell its own story to itself? What's the narrative within elite culture, intelligentsia, the powerful? What's their typical narrative for who and what Bakersfield?
That's an excellent question. It obviously deals with public history and institutional memory. I can give a couple of anecdote examples and then go from there. So I teach for the past 10 years or so at Bakersfield College, including the Bakersfield College Delano campus. So the Delano campus was founded in the aftermath of the Delano Grape Strike, in part because I think of so much of the national attention that was brought onto Delano, both negative and positive, right? And I think the bringing of higher education to the children of farm workers and farm workers themselves could get everybody could get on board with that mission. And so, having spent a decade there, teaching history, California history, ethnic studies, Chicano history, I was curious about how the history of Delano itself is recognized and institutionalized, right? I knew that, say, maybe 10 years or so before I got there had been a very public conversation in the media about the naming of Robert Kennedy High School and the naming of Cesar Chavez High School, both opposition and supportive arguments to that effect. And it was, again, a pretty public conversation. And of course, the arguments for the naming of those high schools won out. But I remember going to the local historical society, the museum, and just trying to see how farm workers of varying stripe were represented in the history. It was fairly minimal. I remember a conversation with someone who was on an advisory board to maybe the local history association. I can't remember the exact name of the organization. It might have been the museum, but it was pretty clear that they don't deal with those topics. And so juxtapose that with the students I'm teaching, who many of whom work in the fields, their parents work in the fields. They might come from undocumented families, and I'm trying to infuse the curriculum and the local into how they experience their education. It's very difficult to do. Of course, I've leaned on some of the great digital history projects that deal with the farm worker movement, but it's nice when students can see themselves reflected in the history locally, like visiting somewhere. So part of the stuff I've done in my teaching is doing site-based visits, places like the Agbayani Village at 40 Acres in Delano, the Filipino Community Hall. These places are historic landmarks recognized by both the state and the federal government, and eventually the national parks, as well as a number of other sites. For example, where the Farm Workers Theater, the Teatro Campesino was in Delano, sites associated with Filipino nationalists from the era of the Spanish American War. But all of that is disconnected, as you say, from the local intelligentsia or the historical societies and public education. In Bakersfield, which is just south, I use the term Greater Bakersfield to encompass these rural peripheries that have strong cultural migratory connections to Bakersfield. The Historical Society, I think, or the Kern County Museum has gotten better in the last 10 years at dealing with this. I did a big public history event in Delano where we did all these tours with the Filipino Historical Society. The director came out and joined the tour, and it was new to him. He had never done it before. I think there's a reckoning that's happening with local institutions, K through 12, college, and university. I'll throw in Cal State Bakersfield here. So I think it was earlier this year in 2024, CSU Bakersfield held what they called the Chavez Huerta Leadership Conference. And what that did is it built upon some of the work that myself and Professor Adam Sawyer had done with the National Endowment for the Humanities and doing site-based visits in the greater Bakersfield, Kern County, San Joaquin area associated with farm worker history. And they took a group of students, administrators, professors up to La Paz, the National Monument, and did a site-based tour and held a conference at the university. Now, I juxtapose that with 50 years ago when John Butler, who was a professor of history, religious studies at Yale, his first job at a graduate school was at Cal State College, then not university. And when I was serving on governance for Organization of American Historians, it was a meeting, I think it was in New Orleans or DC or something like that, but he comes right up to me. I never met him. I'd read all his work, and he's Oliver. I got to tell you this story. And he basically proceeded to tell me that when he just got out of graduate school and came to Bakersfield, thinking he was right near the coast. But basically, he says, I remember one of our first faculty meetings with the administration, and it must have been a vice president or something like this. He told the faculty, you know, you don't talk about Cesar Chavez, you don't talk about the United Farm Workers. And this is like 1970, 71, after the contracts had been signed. So again, 50, 60 years later, CSUB is finally recognizing the dramatic and wide impact of the UFW, both in and beyond the field. So I applaud them for that. But it's taken a long time. It's taken a long time, is my point.
Yeah, I and think that's, I mentioned why, that's why yeah, discussions, monolithic discussions about university system are so frustrating, because a third of U.S. students are educated in conservative state-run universities throughout the South and the Midwest. And these discussions about universities drive me crazy. But let's jump to some specific questions I have about terms before we get into the book, because civil rights, activism, and segregation are all incredibly complex, historically loaded terms. And I think a lot of those terms, maybe civil rights and segregation, are really in people's minds isolated to a specific period in the Jim Crow South. And so could you, in succession, unpack what you mean by those terms so we can use them?
Yeah. So the book draws upon my dissertation that I did at UC Santa Barbara that I finished in 2012. And the heart of my dissertation was on activism, post-World War II activism, multiracial activism. I looked at the Chicano movement. I looked at the war on poverty and really coalitions that emerged between African-American organizations in Bakersfield and Mexican-American organizations. That was the kind of heart of the work. In trying to move from a dissertation to publication with a university press, one of the things that the press wanted, and I'll say about UT Press, one thing I love is that their editor is from Bakersfield. So she knew the history and was like, we got to get this book to the finish line. But she also wanted, and the editors wanted, and the viewers wanted, they wanted some kind of primer on activism, because a lot of the things that activists were mobilizing against were legacies of segregation. Now, no one had written on this topic. It's never been done. So I was like, oh, how am I gonna try to do this? So I had to do an introductory chapter that tried to lay out a story of racial segregation. And I knew this anecdotally. My family grew up in Southeast Bakersfield. They grew up in what was a segregated community with mostly Black and Brown folks. And then eventually they moved to West Bakersfield after the integration of the Bakersfield City School District. So I knew, again, anecdotally from aunts and uncles, school yearbooks, that things were segregated. But how do you tell that story? How do you write that narrative? That opening chapter was hard to do. I will say I applaud the work being done at Cal State Bakersfield with the Historical Research Center, particularly archivist Chris Livingston and Donato Cruz, who are starting to gather some of the data related to redlining practices in Bakersfield. Bakersfield didn't meet the urban threshold, so there's no FHA maps like Fresno. And that's part because I think of how the municipal boundaries have been drawn in Bakersfield to exclude communities of color. But what they're doing essentially is going into the hall records and trying to look at the tracks and then using GIS to map segregation. So I was able to lean on some of that data. Also, historian Al Camarillo at Stanford, he was the consultant for the Luna v. Kern case, which found the Board of Supervisors guilty of racial gerrymandering practices in, I think it was maybe 2018, something like this. But as a historical consultant for that case, not only did he read my dissertation, but he went deeper and trying to narrate for judge and jury, so to speak, the long history of what he calls Juan Crow in the Central Valley, including Bakersfield. So that, along with a kind of other historiographical review, as well as integrating my own family's narrative a little bit into that opening chapter, tries to paint that story of de facto and de jure racial segregation practices to try to blow up that binary into
understanding
how
I had not heard that term
works.
Before, Juan Crow. That,
yeah, yeah,
was that created yeah. in that particular
I think
situation?
I think Al Camarillo coined that term.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's now added to my lexicon. That's fascinating.
I think he used it when he was president of the Organization of American Historians. He gave his presidential address and he talked about racial borderhoods, and he's used that pretty regularly, that whole idea of Juan Crow, just out west. And anyway, so long story short is that's how I approach the history of racial segregation. There's still so much work that could be done on that, but I think my book is a groundwork for future explorations of these topics in the valley. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah. Let's jump into some things you talk about in the introductory chapter. What happens when we make farm labor the exclusive discussion around civil rights and, segregation and activism? What happens when we reduce it to that?
So I think I'm trying to intervene in a historiographical conversation among scholars who have looked at what we might call the rise and fall or the declension narrative of the United Farm Workers. Matt Garcia, Miriam Paul, Christian Pais. So many scholars in the last 10, 15 years have published new books on Caesar, Dolores, the movement. And it's all great. I love the scholarship. But having attended conferences and read books, I'm always slightly irritated reading about how people talk about Kern County because I'm like, there's just so much that's not written, especially when we think about, again, a rise and fall or declension narrative. So I think what I'm trying to do is to reimagine, reposition how the story of civil rights is told in the Valley, both in terms of the impact of the United Farm Workers, the farm worker movement, but also just in challenging legacies of power, which is what made the union such a threat. I think when we talk about social revolution, it wasn't just about contracts or wages. It was also about changing a political culture. So I think I'm speaking to that with my book. I'm also a historical consultant to the redoing of the National Chavez Center Public History Exhibit at the National Monument. And these are questions that we're dealing with very deliberately and trying to just, again, reframe the legacy, the innovations of the United Farm Workers for a multilingual audience, both in English and Spanish. Again, I history doesn't end in 1983. So I think when the labor and civil rights legacy of Central California is only told through the lens of the farm worker movement, we're missing out on urban populations that didn't exist in farm labor, as well as, again, the civil rights reform efforts that were galvanized by the farm worker movement that experience different levels of success and failure. And again, not everybody was a farm worker. I think I lead on that point somewhere where my dad's family, they were more urban, industrial, railroad workers, whereas my mother's family had more of an ag background.
I don't think you can really understand Bakersfield with understanding the Dust Bowl and the Oki migrations. I actually did a podcast recently, and I don't think it's posted yet, that looks at different components of LA history. And one of the discussions we had was about the anti-immigrant sentiment in Los Angeles as Okies made their way west. And so the Oki history is complicated, but with it, it has created this very distinct brand of agrarianism. How would you describe kind of Bakersfield's agrarianism?
That's a great question. I'm a big fan of obviously James Gregory, Peter LaChapelle's book, Proud to Be an Okie. Those are formative studies. Not that long ago, I hosted James Gregory for a webinar at Bakersfield College, and it was so cool to see him reflect on his work and coming to Bakersfield in that era. I think it was the 80s when he was doing his research, and how it's evolved over time, and the work that he's doing now in examining civil rights in a place like Seattle. To answer the question, I think in terms of ideology, agrarian ideology, or what David Vogt calls horticulturalist ideology, I think that's very accurate that farm workers, especially when you look at, say, Latino males and how they voted for Trump and or what Gustavo Arellano calls a rancher libertarianism, I think all of that is intersecting with the kind of values of what we might call a kind of horticulturalist ideology that folks buy into. Another point, too, that I think is unexplored a little bit is what happens to the Okies in terms of their mobility going into professions that are unionized, that they can join unions because they're not Black, and the kind of ascendancy that they have in a place like Bakersfield and moving into institutions of power. I don't think that story's been fully told. And like you said, there's a remembrance of the discrimination or exclusion that they faced in the NEH program that we do at Cal State Bakersfield. We're doing it in 2025. One of the places that we go to, of course, is the Sunset Labor Camp. And we meet with folks from the, I'm forgetting the name of the organization, but it might be like the Okie Preservation Committee. The LA Times did a great series on how that community essentially is basically dying off, and there's no one to take over the mantle of remembering that Okie story, and how it's mostly Latinos like in that area today, or that migrant camp at Sunset Labor, the setting of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, it's all migrant Mexican workers. There's a wonderful play. I would encourage anybody listening to check it out if it's still running its series called Mother Road. It's basically about the Joad family going back to Oklahoma, and this time they're intermarried with Mexicans, and it's a really fun observation about the evolution of the Okies and how it's connected to a Mexican migrant past. Again, I think the Okie ideology, agrarian ideology, is omnipresent in the Valley. But again, at least in my book, I think civil rights activists of varying stripes were trying to challenge its hold on the Valley in some ways. I think that's part of the overarching framework. But again, I think there's more work that needs to be done on unearthing the evolution of Okies, both in terms of their mobility, their social mobility, and how they come to control historical narrative in public spaces.
All right, let's jump into kind of some discussions around segregation. I went to high school in Bakersfield, so I was very cognizant of segregation. And I wanted to talk about it in this way. Sometimes I see segregation as emergent, a coalition of forces trying to separate people. And then sometimes it's centrally planned. How would you describe it using that kind of like conceptual framing there as like emergent versus centrally planned? Because as you referenced before, Bakersfield didn't meet some markers for
Yeah.
segregation at a larger scale. So how do you conceptualize it?
So the way that I conceptualize and deal with racial segregation, as I said, I start off by looking at the housing market and Southeast Bakersfield as a geographical space that was segregated by restrictive covenants. And then I also try to couple that with anecdotes from activists and the focus of their organizing efforts in that area. I also look at the struggle for annexation in the early 1950s by groups like the Sunset Mayflower Progressive Club and eventually the Civic Unity Movement. I note efforts by activists to get the city council, the board of supervisors, to remove Jim Crow signs. But again, a lot of that is centered in Southeast Bakersfield. So that's one way I deal with it. Over time, though, is that emergent or, as you say, like practices of exclusion? On the latter, I try to deal, and I say try, I underscore try, with segregation within the Bakersfield City School District. Now, the short answer with the school district is after the Brown decision, obviously there's effort across America to integrate. And also things like resistance to integration and white flight and the massive resistance. But in Bakersfield, there was a test case to go after a school district for de facto segregation. It lasts a long time. The investigations by Health, Education, and Welfare, and then later the Department of Justice, go on for something like 15 years. I had to go to the National Archives to get those documents. The school district was not and has not really been forthcoming in overturning some of their records. And I'm thinking here about a really wonderful book on school integration in Oxnard, California, by a guy named David Garcia at UCLA called Strategies of Segregation. And what made his book so special is he forced got the Oxnard district to overturn their records that they had been sitting on and didn't want to turn over because you're looking at board meetings and such where boundary lines are being drawn, curriculum is being discussed regarding the racialized population in Oxnard. So I'm pretty certain that, and I try to position the evidence as such, that a similar effort probably would yield great results in Bakersfield. But I have not been successful heretofore in getting the district to overturn some of that stuff. But I do lean on the investigations by Department of Justice and Health, Education, Welfare, and some of the rulings that came out against the BCSD for their exclusionary practices, that all kind of culminate in a consent decree where basically the district is going to concede and do integrative practices by creating magnet programs to draw white enrollment to black schools, essentially Mexican schools, but not admit guilt. So those are the two kind of primary ways I deal with segregation in Bakersfield. It's certainly not holistic. There's a lot more work that can be done on this. I know there's a recent professor at San Francisco State University who's from Bakersfield, and she's not in history. She's in, I think, criminal justice and has a background in GIS. But I chaired a panel at the Western History Association a few years ago where she talked about resegregation in the current high school district. And she looked at the high schools that are the West High School and their enrollment data, say from 2000, 2015 or something like this, and really charted and mapped out segregation. So that's a really exciting project that she's doing. It's outside the scope of my historical analysis, but obviously the two are connected, and my book can't speak entirely for what's happening in a city like Bakersfield in the 21st century.
Can you tell the story that you reference at the end of your chapter on segregation about the signs that went up across the street from Bakersfield High School? I think it's illustrative in a couple different ways, but I'd love for you to tell it.
Yeah, so I actually learned about this in a couple of different ways. One is through Ken Hooper. Ken Hooper is the archivist at Bakersfield High School. He's been there for 30 years. He knows every inch of where every document is buried at Bakersfield High School, which has got to be one of the oldest high schools in the state. It's been around for, I think, at least a century. And so I knew that in around 1950, the city council and then later the board of supervisors passed ordinances to get the city and county to basically take down their Jim Crow signs. I also knew local groups like the NAACP, I believe it was the Negro Ministers Association, as well as the Civic Unity Movement, had put that pressure, right, on public officials to pass those ordinances. And I had reached out to Ken. I'm trying to remember the specific query. I think I had heard about this incident at the Elbow Inn, this food stand across the street. And Ken, of course, knew about it. And I think he had put together even a kind of short presentation, maybe that his students had done, because across the street from Bakersfield High School, there was going to be a food stand, right? And all these kids, you go to downtown Bakersfield today, it's a popular place for kids because it's an open campus. And so this business was going to set up and have that sign that talked about basically no colored trade solicited and having segregative employment and spacing. And the students mobilized against this. And I think it really captured young people's spirit, right? And not wanting that to go up in their local community. And again, it also spoke to other work that I had done at that moment when there was a very active civic unity movement among some of the religious groups. So a lot of pressure was put on the school in the campus newspaper. Students wrote op-eds. There was counter protests trying to force the closure of that practice, and they were successful in that regard. And I think what was key for me is that because of the high profile nature of students trying to fight segregated practices, that also leaned into efforts by adults and religious groups to put pressure then on the city council and the board of supervisors to also restrict Jim Crow signs city and countywide. And again, it served as a kind of, precursor for stuff that I was going to look at later in the 1960s and 70s regarding youth activism. And again, it was a coalition. It wasn't just Black kids, but it was Bakersfield High School has always been a kind of multiracial space. Bakersfield College at that time, or Bakersfield High School at that time, excuse me, was also had the college on campus. Bakersfield College, where I work, was at the high school for about 50 years. And then it established its flagship Panorama campus in Northeast Bakersfield years later.
Your second chapter was fascinating for me in so many different ways, learning about all these different kind of political action organizations. I want to start by talking about the IRB. How and why was that created, and how would you describe its either its efficacy or lack thereof?
Yeah, the IRB was the effort of the city council, the Intergroup Relations Board, to I think really deal with the civil rights question. And I think it also represented the kind of hopes, the aspirations of Black folks in Bakersfield, especially, but also Mexican Americans, that the city was on board with trying to enact racial progressivism, racial reform. And I think if you read the book from front to end, Earl Warren, being governor of California, later Supreme Court justice, he had a reputation, obviously with internment, but also with some racial progressive elements. So I think the IRB represented, again, the aspirations of people of color in the city, that the city was going to take civil rights reform seriously. And for me, as a point of evidence, the city council minutes were incredibly rich because the city council's meetings in the early 60s and late 50s were loaded with Black folks, brown folks speaking for lengthy times. The 3 minute rule was not in effect yet. That comes later, I think. It may be in part because of the activism. And it was also key to see local activist groups, religious groups, try to use the IRB process to reform hiring practices or other aspects or institutions in Bakersfield to promote reform and integration. I think that what happens, though, ultimately with the IRB from the activist perspective, is it was a kind of false sense of optimism that working with the city council had limitations and that direct action was also needed. So as I explore in that chapter, there's a movement, a growth by the civic unity movement to independently organize itself, aside from putting all of its faith in the IRB as an institution. And racial liberalism, which I look at holistically and that scholars of civil rights also explore, is basically this idea of using the state, using the power of government to expand the New Deal and to make up for the racial outcomes that weren't fulfilled during the New Deal. And that's based on faith in government. And so that's what I'm exploring a little bit through these activists and about how they try to oppress government. And they get some success. So Del Rucker is like a character I look at. He's one of the first. I don't think he was the first, but he was one of the first and longest staying Black city councilmen in Bakersfield from Southeast Bakersfield. So that position was always, that seat in the council was always a kind of a civil rights seat, a voice of reason, a voice where Black folks and brown folks could go to have that kind of public discourse, which I think is important. I think public discourse is important, even if it doesn't yield results per se. So that's what the IRB was. It was a kind of, it represented the faith of racial liberalism, I think, among activist groups.
Do you perceive the White Citizens Council as a fringe group in Bakersfield political history or something that's central? I think there's a lot of discussion around the role of some of these, the Klan's influence in Bakersfield's history. Some of it is overstated and sometimes it's understated. So how do you perceive this particular role?
That's a great question. So the short answer is I think more research needs to be done on white supremacist groups, anti-integration groups. I'm not doing that research explicitly, being that my research focuses on activists. I can give an anecdote. So I think it was at I gave a recent book talk in Bakersfield, or I was at an event talking about my research. And I had a colleague come up to me and he said to me, and he's on the staff at Bakersfield College, I won't use his name, but he basically said that he, in a kind of former life, so to speak, used to do some, what's the word, clandestine observations of fringe groups. And he started telling me about Oildale, California. Now, of course, anybody who grew up in Bakersfield knows about Oildale, California, just from anecdotes. But he started talking, and I cross-referenced what he was telling me with Chris Livingston, who's the Historical Research Center Director at Cal State Bakersfield, who also has a keen interest. He grew up in Arvin, a white guy, right? But a very sensitive to landmarks, right? And in talking about spaces in Oildale associated with white supremacy, and one of the things that my colleague was telling me about the Klan, and about, he knew the location of somebody who used to be a sort of higher up in the Klan. And also, I think there was a tree he was talking about that had certain kinds of markings on it. And I was totally fascinated by the things that he was telling me. Of course, anecdotally, we have oral history accounts of the sign that was supposed to be on North Chester. And so with the White Citizens Council, there's names of folks who were the organizers. There was strong connection between Mississippi and Bakersfield. The title of my book is called Civil Rights in Bakersfield, but my dissertation title was called Mississippi West. And even a character like Marshall Ganz, who I talked about in the book a little bit, he was from Bakersfield, went to Harvard, stopped going, and then went down to Mississippi to organize Black voters, then comes back to Bakersfield and sees Bakersfield with what he calls Mississippi eyes. And the other point I'll note too, and I'll mention Donato Cruz, who also works at the HRC at Cal State Bakersfield. His master's thesis talks about the history of a white supremacist who was a very popular AM radio talk show host who had a show based in Bakersfield, but also had more sort of national broadcast. But he found some of the FBI files on this guy and his connections to white supremacist groups. So the point is I think there are the anecdotes, and as you say, some of it might be overplayed given the decline of the Klan in the 20s, but I think there's just a lot more research that needs to be done on this topic. There's a historian, I think she's out of Nevada. She's looked at the incident in Taft where the Black football players get chased out of town. So again, I hope that my book brings some of this to the fore and encourages more investigations. But my own sense is I don't think it's overplayed at all. I really don't. I just think it needs to be fleshed out by a historian.
Absolutely. I would love to read that if it is. Let's talk a little bit about the War on Poverty. You devote some time to this, and I've got two questions. I'll just ask them together. How did the local kind of conservative political establishment interact with CAPS programs? And can you talk a little bit about the difficulty? I think in some respects, we understand the difficulty with seasonal work and farm labor, but maybe not quite understanding the seasonal work in the oil industry, which, if you don't live in Bakersfield or don't live in an oil town, it can be hard to understand how that world works.
So let me start, I guess, by saying one of the things that sort of surprised me in the research process or of how I thought about the war on poverty. So one point is the infusion of federal resources in terms of expanding activist potential, activist possibility, as well as working with government, working with the federal government. So the IRB is, of course, working with local government, but the war on poverty allows activist groups to connect with federal entities, right? So it's still, in my view, part of this kind of racial liberal experience. The other point I think that's key is, shifting the voter base away from the Democratic Party. And so I look at Congressman Harlan Hagan, who was a longtime Democratic congressman who worked with Cesar Chavez. He worked with Dolores Huerta. He worked with the Community Service Organization. And then because of the granting of a war on poverty grant for like $250,000 to the National Farm Workers Association, weeks before the launch of the Delano grape strike, it really calls this crisis moment into the war on poverty and Democratic politics. And it's all the correspondence was really focusing on that. It was because no one knew the grape strike was going to last for as long as it did. But I think a lot of voters and folks who worked in ag were shocked, one, by the fact that this person, this relatively unknown person, Cesar Chavez, got this very large grant, and then he's on strike. And so people are thinking he's going to use those federal dollars to sustain his strike. So the effect that had politically on somebody like a Harlan Hagan, I found fascinating, and I try to account for that story. To your question about the relationship of local folks or local Republicans or conservatives to community action programs. So in many major American cities, and there's a whole historiography on the war on poverty that I'm trying to speak to a little bit, is a lot of cities were supportive, obviously, of federal dollars coming in. Like it wasn't as divisive, perhaps. It was just a kind of way for bringing home the bacon, so to speak, for whoever was in office. And I found the way that the community action programs were implemented in Kern, a place like Kern, especially after 1966 when Reagan is in office, and there's a sort of political, the winds are shifting, if you will, that the Republicans strategically use CAP to limit, target, destroy the war on poverty. And that's how you wreck things. It was a bad idea to begin with, right? So you use the mechanisms of government to talk about why ultimately the war on poverty was a failure and it encouraged dependency, that kind of thing. So I look at a little bit of that, but the war on poverty goes on for quite some time. Community action programs are still around. In a later chapter, I look at the Clínica Sierra Vista Origins, which used to be called Clínica de los Campesinos or Farm Workers Clinic. Now, today, Clínica Sierra Vista is one of the largest healthcare providers in rural San Joaquin Valley, but its origins are in this fight to expand rural healthcare. To an extent, like I said, I think there's a general acceptance for war on poverty programs or expanding healthcare infrastructure. But at the time, at the origins of it was connected more to activism and again, shifting political grounds, I think. And I think activists also learn their lessons. I noticed that some of the activists that I look at, say in the early 70s, had experience in the war on poverty and kind of had a bad taste in their mouth, I think, in some ways. And eventually there's competition that emerges too between Black and Brown groups in terms of grant opportunities and such. But I think in its origins, like in 64, 65, 66, I'm trying to look at the way that the influx of federal resources changes activist calculations and organizing, and then also again shifts political trajectories. Could you remind me about your question on oil?
Yeah, I'm curious about we understand the seasonal nature of agricultural work and why it's difficult for governments to provide services when people are transient. But I was curious about how you perceive that in relation to work in the oil industry.
I don't deal exclusively with oil as an industry per se in the book, but I will say just drawing anecdotally from my experiences with students. I have a lot of students who work in oil of many stripes. And as you say, oil's up, oil's down. Generally, when oil's down, we're going to get a large influx of enrollment at a place like Bakersfield College.
Makes sense,
And
yeah.
it, yeah, or you have students who are trying to, earn their degree. I have students who work on rigs. I have a brother-in-law who works on a rig. As I think about that laboring population, I do note somewhere in the book about the exclusion of Black folks from the oil industry in terms of joining unions. I think also oil culture is, there's a whole historiography on oil culture and sound that I find fascinating. And a lot of environmental justice organizing is happening, of course, on the ground related to shifting energy markets. The Kern community, Gavin Newsom, our governor, was just in Kern County yesterday. I think he was up at Tejon looking at a kind of renewable energy facility. But there's this whole trying to shift to a carbon neutral economy and the effects that has on workers. And again, that I think my book hopefully exposes a landscape of organizing tactics that again provide a genealogy of organizing. But again, there's just so much that can be written, I think, on the area. I can think of probably like three books.
I'm sure
One
there's a lot of them there.
I get questions oftentimes about LGBTQ activism, which I don't really deal with in my book. But again, there's a whole history of that in Kern, especially in Bakersfield. I remember when I was in college in Berkeley, I had a landlord who was a homosexual, and he used to tell me about going to Bakersfield in the 1950s and how it was like the Las Vegas. It was a Wild West for kind of subterranean gay culture.
Please,
We have
someone write that book. Please.
I'm forgetting his name, Roy Ashburn, right? The former member of the California legislature, Republican. I think he got the media exposed him of going to a gay nightclub in Sacramento. And the point is, there's a history of a sort of, if you will, clandestine, underground gay Bakersfield. I did an interview with Whitney Waddell, who's like the godmother of the history of lesbian gay archives in Bakersfield. And the fascinating thing about that history is she talked about places, like physical places in urban Bakersfield that was safe for gay folks to go, for lesbians to go, to socialize. And then she juxtaposed that with the violence and the murders and things that were in the media that were reported, but not as well covered because it might have been somebody gay who was killed and such. So again, there's a whole activist history related to sexuality and gender that needs to be told. And then, of course, immigrant rights. My book kind of ends in the 1980s. And my hope is that some young person, some graduate student can pursue that. And I'd say the same thing for oil. I don't deal with it exclusively in the book, but anecdotally, again, it's an important workforce, but it's one that's undergoing a lot of change. We'll see what happens in Trump 2.0 with fracking and such, but
Okay, I want to jump now to some 20,000 foot perspective questions. And I want to ask you about in your concluding chapter, your conclusion to the book, you bring up a story about the tabling of Willie Rivera's resolution. Why did you feel like it was pertinent to include that? And what does it represent for you about the history of civil rights and activism in Bakersfield?
yeah, I was at that meeting. So I remember, I can't remember how I came to go to that meeting. I think activists were trying to organize around his proposal to draw attention to the need for immigration reform. And I remember sitting in the city council chambers, and I don't know, I haven't been to the city council in a while. So yeah, I'm a historian. I spend, most of my time teaching or in archives. But it was nice to see that activism in action. And I remember being outside the chambers when a lot of the groups were talking, decompressing, just reflecting on the moment and thinking to myself, gosh, I'm revising my dissertation into this manuscript and witnessing the city council being used as this space for activism today. And I remember having those conversations with folks and basically saying, I was like, what you're doing is part of this longer history, right? Of people of color, Black folks, Latinos, and in this case, folks who are supporting immigration reform and trying to press, even if it was going to be a fool's errand or the city council wasn't going to pass the resolution, it didn't matter. It was more important that they engage the public discourse, right? And it has a kind of multiplying effect in keeping the spirits high, if you will, right? In terms of mobilizing a community and organizing. So I think that ultimately that's why I included it, because to me, it represented why I was writing the book and trying to understand Bakersfield, the city, its people as and its activist history. So that's ultimately why I included that story.
Okay. I want to ask an inversion of a question I asked earlier, and is a potential criticism of your book. So, how would you respond to, let's say, leaders in the UFW Foundation or someone like that says your book is really, in some ways, decentering farm labor and activism by focusing on something else? Is that what's wrong with that criticism of your book?
So I think that's a fair question. Again, I think that the United Farm Workers, the Cesar Chavez Foundation, the National Chavez Center, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, all of the organizations, both unions and nonprofits that have an investment in the legacy of the farm worker movement have also, they've always been keen on responding to historians and also telling their own story. So I don't criticize them for doing that. I think even Cesar Chavez was skeptical in the heyday of the United Farm Workers to work with academics. Like even going back to like his early days, like when folks from Stanford would want to study farm workers and want to interview him or something like that, it was like, why? You're just going to come in here, ask some questions and leave. What outcome does it have? So I would respond to any organization that poses a question like that. Why am I writing the book? It's so young people, it's so students, it's so people. I think I end the book by saying I dedicate this book to the good people of Bakersfield who want to imagine a better future for the city. And that ultimately, like I said, the legacy of the farm worker movement is also beyond the fields. And in many ways, that's the richer legacy, right? If you look at how many farm workers are under contract right now, or the UFW was ultimately always interested in more than contracts, it was always more than a union. So I would counter to that point and say, I think my book is ultimately exposing that kind of broader landscape of reform that the UFW was a catalyst for, that the UFW ultimately affected. So that's probably how I respond to that kind of criticism.
Okay. Let's imagine a young activist, maybe in their 20s or early 30s, picks up your book to draw some lessons about what has been effective in Bakersfield's history vis-a-vis activism. What lessons do you think they would learn about effective ways to approach that agenda?
That's a great question. So the second book talk I gave for this was, the first one was in Fresno, and the second one was at the Juarez Hall in Southeast Bakersfield, which is the Bakersfield's oldest Mexican mutualista going back to 100 years. And a similar question was posed because there were a lot of young folks there, intergenerational folks, Black folks, Brown folks. And what I said is that there's a sort of organizational hero in the book, which is the current Council for Civic Unity. Because when that organization was effective, it's because it brought together different groups. It brought together different organizations in a common effort. And that takes work. Coalitions are not inevitable, they are not predetermined. They take careful organizing by organizers to find common ground to mobilize constituents. And so ultimately, I think that for a young person or an activist who's doing work on the ground today in the Central Valley, that's what I would want them to take away from it, is that in order to be effective as an organizer, you have to build coalitions. And that, again, at least within this region of California, there's a long history of coalition building that has had success. And again, in other urban contexts or in other historiographical explorations of coalition building during the civil rights era, I think Bakersfield can serve as a model for ways that coalitions were effectively built and also the challenges that they faced, but it wasn't inherently divisive, that it wasn't something that there's a perennial conflict, say, between Black and Brown, which there's a whole scholarship on that as well. At the same time, there's limits of coalitions. For example, I point this out that I don't think that some of the white racial liberals who are part of these coalitions had a firm understanding of Chicano nationalism or Black nationalism. To a detriment. I hope that in retrospect, the book also moves beyond some of the divisiveness that also defined, say, a period like the 1970s and gives that kind of critical distance for perspective. So that's my hope for readers and activists today, that again, that they come away with a far greater appreciation of the need and strategies for building coalitions.
Okay. If you're thinking globally, how the research on this subject has affected your kind of views, how would you say it's changed your views of Bakersfield history and then California history, respectively?
It's a great question. Let me start with California. I teach California history. How do I talk about the San Joaquin Valley? I think about it. Of course, I mentioned Miller Lux Company or industrial cowboys or riparian rights or the Oki migration. But in terms of the curriculum, that might be about as far as one gets. And then you fast forward maybe to the United Farm Workers. But for, I think, a lot of students, for myself included, that's not enough. There needs to be a more diverse array of characters and issues that relate to urban history, that relate to race relations, that students find interesting. And local history. I want students to be able to, especially students in Bakersfield and the Valley, to be able to read the book and get interested in local history, get interested in their communities, get interested in interviewing their grandparents, their parents, their aunts and uncles, and trying to understand archives. That's the other thing we haven't talked extensively about, but Bakersfield and the Valley, I think, has an archives problem. I think that there's efforts to try to remediate that, but there's a lot of work that can be done. And there's also, again, a lot of history of the Valley that's not in the Valley. And so hopefully the footnotes and the bibliography provide a kind of a pathway for people to understand where they can go to research those questions. On a larger scale, nationally, globally, California, it's a unique space. The Valley is a unique space. I think being anecdotally the breadbasket of the world, it's not just a farm labor history, right? Again, there's a more urban history. There's a I'm not sure who said this, but the Valley is this sort of right constructed space. It's one of the most, maybe it's Mark Arax. He talks about the San Joaquin Valley, like the most transformed place in the world, but people live on it, right? And I'm trying to do a people's history in some ways, right? I start off with that kind of quip about how I want more than two names to be remembered about Bakersfield other than Buck Owens and Cesar Chavez. And I think that's my goal. Is I was interviewing with KPFK in Los Angeles and the great historian Gerald Horn just yesterday, or a couple of days ago, in fact. And he asked a similar question about Southern California, right? The millions of people in Southern California, like why, kind of like, why should they care about Bakersfield type question, or what can they learn from Bakersfield? And I said, I was like, Bakersfield has been, especially going back, I think even to the 30s and 40s, a place of organizational hope. As in, if you can cut your teeth and get it done in a place like the Valley, there's hope for activism, there's hope for organizing, there's hope for social justice. And so that's a rich legacy. That's a rich legacy that is not only relevant to California, but for, I think, progressive organizations around the world. I mentioned I'm a consultant for the National Chavez Center exhibit and the redoing of that exhibit. Every other time I go up there to Keene, you meet people from all across the world. There are folks from Sweden who are across the world who do the kind of national monuments tours, and people are interested in the history. It's not entirely parochial, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I will say spending formative years in Bakersfield and thinking about influencing public policy, it's made me into a tough SOB. I'll leave it at that. I think it has a forcing effect on you. And that's why a lot of, and I am one, so this is a marketing campaign. Bakersfield expats are some of the best. So I'll just leave it at that. We're going to close with my favorite section, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners either on this topic or others?
Wow, that's a great question. For California civil rights history, a book that was indispensable for me, I think, was Mark Brilliant's book, The Color of America Has Changed, because he's able to weave together a narrative history of multiracial activism in California that's really statewide. It has a heavily legalistic perspective, which is great in terms of giving it a scope, but as well as a kind of the limits of the book. So that's a really wonderful book. He also, another really good book I read recently, I read a review on it, is I mentioned Christian Pais's book, The Strikers of Coachella. Beautiful book published by University of North Carolina Press. Anything in the University of North Carolina Press, their series, Justice, Power, and Politics, is excellent. They have great editorial staff. But what I like about his book is I didn't know much about Coachella other than just the musical festival. But he just takes a deep dive into the strikers of Coachella and the way that the farmworker movement changed communities and hopes and aspirations of ordinary people. So that's just a great bottom-up grassroots history. Another text that I've read recently that is a little bit different but also critical is Michael Coe's Mexico from the Olmecs to the Aztecs. And I bring this up because it's a little bit older of a text, but it was a kind of cornerstone of anthropology, but it's been updated by some of maybe his graduate students or more recent professors. But I've been teaching it and teaching ethnic studies. And I think what it does for students is it helps them demystify Mexico, right? I'm thinking of another book too by Ana Minayan, her book Undocumented Lives. Because I deal with Mexican immigration, but it's a monolith. And I think both Coe's book and Ana Minayan's book, it helps you gain a kind of better transnational appreciation for the diversity of Mexican immigrants and the kind of cultural baggage, if you will, or cultural change that immigrants experience. And I don't think I quite had that knowledge when I was writing my book. And for me, they've just been incredibly helpful understanding the communities that I teach and the students that I want to read my book. I had a student the other day, is your book available in Spanish? I was like, no, but that's a great query that I want to bring up with the press. And for the La Paz exhibit, I'm working with a guy named Fernando Serrano, who's a professor at Porterville College and is also a Mexicanist, has a PhD from UCLA. And we're doing this bilingual exhibit. I want to reach Spanish-speaking communities, I think both in my scholarship and teaching. And again, Coe's book on Mexican indigeneity and I think Ana Minayan's book help me understand the students that I see in the classroom, right? And who their parents are, who their aunts and uncles are.
Last question. What are you working on next?
So there's a couple of things that I'm doing. I mentioned again the consulting work with the National Chavez Center and the National Parks to redo the exhibit at La Paz. It's set to open in 2027. I'm currently working on a proposal with Gordon Mantler, Felipe Hinojosa, and also a professor at UT Austin on Latino public history that's based on that work, as well as work that they're doing in Latino public history. In 2025, where I'm co-organizing and project directing a National Endowment for the Humanities Landmarks in California History, excuse me, Landmarks in American History and Culture grant that's going to bring 72 teachers across America to Cal State Bakersfield. And we're going to visit Allensworth, California, La Paz, Delano, and also the Sunset Labor Camp in Arvin and have this site-based learning experience. And I'm also serving as a consultant to the Historical Research Center at Cal State Bakersfield for their greater efforts in documenting the history of redlining in Bakersfield. So those are the major projects that I'm working on right now.
That's fantastic. Again, the book is Civil Rights in Bakersfield, Segregation and Multiracial Activism in the Central Valley. Even if you're not from Bakersfield, I think there's a lot to take away from this book. And it examines important periods in the not so distant past that continue to affect the way that activists organize, the work that they do, but then also the strictures that they're going after that continue to limit people's mobility and opportunity. Thank you so much, Dr. Rosales, for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Jordan, for inviting me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.